This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Stop it! Right now.
Or what? Are you threatening me? Because I think I can take you.
Excuse me?
That was my guest, Ron Perlman, speaking first and last in that scene from Hellboy 2, a movie adaptation of the comic book Hellboy. It's just one of several Ron Perlman roles in which his face and or body is covered by prosthetics and special effects makeup. He had a lion-like face in the role that made him famous as the Beast in the TV series Beauty and the Beast, which premiered in 1987. He was also physically transformed for his roles in Quest for Fire, The Name of the Rose, and Star Trek Nemesis. More recently, he's become known for tough guy roles. In the 2011 movie Drive, he was a mobster. And he's now famous for his portrayal of a ruthless, brutal leader of a motorcycle club in the FX series Sons of Anarchy. Perlman has a new memoir called Easy Street, The Hard Way. Let's start with a reading by Perlman from the first chapter of the audiobook. In this passage, he's looking back on himself in 1969 when he was 19. Perlman refers to his younger self as this guy.
This guy, whose future would have him being a Neanderthal, a lion-faced man, a red-tailed, red-bodied, wise-ass devil, a Romulan, a hunchback, a cross-dresser, a cop, a lawyer, a biker, and 100 other personas, was just a 19-year-old kid back then. He was 6'2", with piercing blue eyes and curly blondish hair. He was thick-boned, as they used to call it, though not noticeably overweight as he had been the majority of his childhood. He did, however, have a unique face, a distinctive kisser, as he'd been told 1,000 times, with a pronounced jaw and high forehead. It was the kind of face that was not ugly, but surely one of its kind, and he'd gotten accustomed to people sometimes taking a double look. He had learned to counter this seemingly endless barrage of negativity with a tough guy, good-humored bravado, which he had learned as a necessity to survive when growing up on the streets of Washington Heights, New York City.
Ron Perlman, welcome to Fresh Air. This is going to be fun. I love your voice, so I'm looking forward to hearing it.
I'm excited to be here.
So what had you been told about your face when you were growing up?
I probably wasn't told as many negative things by the outside world as I was told by myself. I mean, you know, most of the source of discomfort, especially now that I look back on it, was self-inflicted. Just esteem things or whatever it was that kind of tripped up my reading of myself and gave me an impression that was something short of completely positive.
Since you were self-conscious as a kid about your face and about your body, because during about 8 years of your childhood, you say you were considered like the fat kid in school. Was it?
No, I wasn't considered. I was.
You were it.
Yeah, that wasn't made up. That was a reality. I mean, you know, I was like I was up around 300 pounds by the time I was 12 and a half, 13 years old, and it stayed that way till I took my college physical, which I failed.
Yeah, so you had to go on a diet and
had to finally, you know, pay the piper.
Right. So since you were self-conscious about your body and your face when you were coming of age, was it helpful for you to literally have a mask to be behind in some of your early roles?
Having a physical layer between myself and the outside world that I was performing to really enabled me to kind of free myself up and not worry about all of the things that my inner voices were saying were in the way of giving the kind of free performance one wants to give when one is portraying a character. So it was kind of like a pattern. I mean, it was one heavy-duty prosthetic makeup transformation after another, you know, starting with the very first one, which was Quest for Fire, then Name of the Rose, then Beauty and the Beast. Those things happened in succession and gave way to The Island of Dr. Moreau and Hellboy and a number of others.
It's funny, you'd done so many roles and prosthetics. and elaborate facial makeup, you decided, like, no more. And then you got the script for Beauty and the Beast, the TV series. First you refused to read it, and then you read it and really liked it. So it's basically like a contemporary version of the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, and you're the Beast. Describe yourself in the character, in the series.
So the character of Vincent in Beauty and the Beast was, this was a character that was an outcast physically and that was not even allowed to roam the earth because it was too dangerous for him, because he would have been a target, and yet who had more humanity than any 15 people you could think of, and a bigger heart and a more beautiful soul. And there it was. I mean, I was being paid to play the Beast on primetime, 8 o'clock Friday nights on CBS. But it was like therapy for me, because I was exercising this very, very deep-seated set of feelings that I needed to get out. And so that was that.
Your character in Beauty of the Beast, his face looks kind of like part man, part lion. Let's play a scene from the TV show. This is a scene, you know, early in the series, like what kicks the story off is that Linda Hamilton, who plays an assistant district attorney, is mugged and nearly killed. But she survives. You find her and bring her down to the underground world where you live, hidden from the rest of the world. And you nurse her back to health. And here's a scene between the two of you.
How did this happen to you?
I don't know how. I have ideas. I'll never know. I was born. And I survived.
That's my guest, Ron Perlman, and Linda Hamilton in the series Beauty and the Beast. You know, you mentioned in your memoir that one of the reasons why you got asked to do the part is that you'd done other prosthetic work and you had a very good reputation among the special effects makeup people, that you could do it. You could be patient enough to get the makeup done, and that also you could show character, you could show emotion coming through whatever prosthetic or makeup was on your face.
Well, no, the state of the art in special effects makeup, and I was lucky enough in Beauty and the Beast to be working with the modern day genius, the guy who was head and shoulders, you know, above everybody else, Rick Baker. You know, the thing is, you look like you're doing a lot of stuff because you're covered, but the makeup is so seamless and so liquid that really all you're doing, the more subtle you are, the more expressive you are. And everything that you're doing, even if you're just thinking something without moving a muscle, it shows through. And when I realized how little I had to do in prosthetic makeup, and that how the makeup was nothing more than just an enhancement, an addition, another layer that added to the texture of the character, it was kind of a liberating feeling for me.
So you're allergic to most of the glues that are used for these prosthetics. I feel for you, because I have such sensitive skin. I understand what it must be like to, but you found one that works?
Actually, right at the outset of my career, they invented this glue, which has since been taken off the market because for some strange reason, it's not good for the environment. So it's been replaced by something else, but it's hyperallergenic.
That's amazing. Isn't that weird? The one thing that's sensitive enough for your skin is bad for the environment.
And I mean,
it's not fair.
I mean, how much of it is getting out into the ether anyway? I mean, there's how many guys are having rubber applied to their face around the world at any given time for the purpose of making a movie? I don't. Of all the things that they wanted to attack, for the sake of the ozone layer. And don't get me wrong, I love the ozone layer as much as the next guy, but, you know, thought that was rather
now I know who to blame for climate change, makeup guy. Let me skip ahead to one of your latest roles, and that's Sons of Anarchy. Now, your character was killed off last season, But you were you know, one of the stars of the series.
I don't think people on the East Coast know that yet, though, do they? Oh, wait a minute. Oops. Is it the West Coast? Or is it New Zealand? Yeah, people in this is just, we just screwed it up for everybody. And sorry, Peter Jackson and all your friends.
So, you know, in Sons of Anarchy, it's kind of like the opposite of Beauty and the Beast. Like, you're a real tough guy in this. And you have like no scruples. You're the head of a very violent motorcycle club. This is like a criminal operation. And you became the president of the club after you plotted to kill the person who had been the head, John Teller. And the person you plotted with was Teller's wife, Gemma, who became your wife. And I want to play a scene in which Gemma has figured out that you actually ordered a hit on her daughter-in-law. And this is the woman who's married to her son, Jax. So Gemma is furious, and she has a gun.
What's the matter? Change your mind? Get a refund because they didn't kill her?
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
You promised me. You looked me in the eye, and you promised me you wouldn't hurt Tara.
You're insane. Had nothing to do with what happened to Tara.
You took money out of that safe this morning. Hours later, somebody goes after Tara. She'd probably be dead if Jax wasn't with her.
You need to stop. Right now.
You didn't know that Jax was going to be with her, did you? Or the boys. Jesus Christ! Those babies could have been hurt!
Enough!
Maybe Jax needs to know that truth. You stay away from me, you son of a... You stay away from my family.
Oh, you gonna kill me, Gemma? Huh? Like you did the first husband.
You killed John.
Nah. Baby. You killed him. You played me for a chump, and I was no match for that tight and a broken, angry heart. Yeah. Maybe Jax needs to read some of that truth.
That's a scene from Sons of Anarchy with my guest, Ron Perlman, playing Clay Morrow. And Ron Perlman has written a new memoir, which is called Easy Street, The Hard Way. How did you get the part? Did you have to audition for it?
I did have to audition for it. They had already shot the pilot with another actor playing Clay Morrow. And the network decided that they weren't getting what they were hoping to get. And that they were willing to, they loved the series enough to, if they thought they found the right actor, they were willing to reshoot the pilot and restart the clock and greenlight the show for a whole first season, which is 13 episodes. So they met with me and they said, you know, the caveat is, you know, this is a big risk we're taking. We would love for you to consider coming in and reading for the show. And I was more than happy to do that. Read for it, got it. We reshot most of the pilot, and merrily we rolled along.
Did you have any idea what the original actor had done wrong that they thought was not quite right for the part?
The original actor is a brilliant actor. I won't mention his name, but I'm a huge fan of his. But he's a very subtle guy, and he has a very kind of a quiet, understated presence about him. Which, in terms of this particular guy, Clay Morrow, they were looking for way more dynamic. They were looking for higher highs and lower lows and a lot of very, very kind of...
volatility.
Resonant things. And, you know, much more explosive, much more unpredictable, and much more capable of this kind of dark humor that exists in worlds where life and death are, you know, constantly, you know, coexisting. So I understood going into it that, you know, that they were looking for a more operatic version of this guy. And just so happened, happened to be free that week.
Had you ever ridden a motorcycle?
I had learned to ride a motorcycle for a movie that never happened. So just as I was getting my sea legs under me, it got pulled out from under me. And I never rode any more than that until Sons of Anarchy came around. And depending on who you ask, I never did much riding after the fact either. me and the bike, let's put it this way. I'd rather be eating Haagen-Dazs. That's my wheelhouse, baby.
Did you feel like you should meet any motorcycle gang members before doing the series?
That was all done for us. You know, Kurt Sutter created the show, spent a lot of time in Northern Cali hanging out with the real deal guys. And so by the time we started shooting, there were a bunch of them on set with us who were kind of consulting and making sure that we got the mores and the customs and the sort of, you know, swagger right, and that we weren't doing a kind of a one-dimensional kind of a... what you see in a lot of movies, you see a lot of movies about motorcycle gangs and everybody's scratching and everybody's fat and everybody's hairy, and, you know, it's kind of like, it's almost like a caricature version. We really, not we, but Kurt really went out of his way to make sure that we had the endorsement of the MC world because we took the time to be as authentic and as subtle and as gray rather than black and white as we possibly could be. So I laud him for that.
Your character really goes off the rails after a while. You know, he betrays everyone, including, you know, everyone in the motorcycle club. He goes to prison. He bites off part of a guard's face. And you read in your memoir that when your character started becoming a pariah after betraying everyone he knew, you felt like you were being treated like a pariah on the set, as if everybody could sense that your character wasn't long for the world and therefore you weren't long for the set. What were you picking up on?
I was experiencing being cut from the herd, you know, being isolated, truly isolated. I mean, you know, that last season I spent on the show, I pretty much never saw anybody that I had been working with for the prior 6 years. Until the last episode when they offed me. I was doing kind of a separate show. And the isolation and the kind of exile was not just character driven, it was also physical in nature. And
'cause you were in different scenes.
The closeness that had characterized the first few years of the show when we were all getting to know each other and all getting so swept up in what it was that we were a part of had turned into something else, something much more lonely, much darker, much, okay, this is it. I'm done. I'm out of this world. And surely enough, in short order, I was.
How did you find out your character was going to be killed off? Did you find out about that through the script you were given? Did Kurt Sutter, the creator of the show, tell you?
He brought me in at the beginning of season 6 and told me that I would not make it to the end of the season, and that I would find my demise at the end of that season. So that's how I found out.
And I imagine you were sorry to hear that.
I was surprised because it ran counter to what had already always been the plan.
What had been the plan?
The plan was I was going to make it all the way through. Something changed. I'm not really sure what, nor is it important that I ever answer that question. But the plan changed. And so, I think he had a plan in his mind about how season 6 unfolded for me. And there was supposed to be some sort of major redemption in Clay's character. And then that morphed into something else as well. So season 6 was rather uncomfortable for me on a lot of levels, partially because of how much I grew to love the guys and the world of the show and what we had built together. And, it was what it was. And it was never anything that was in my control. the places the character went were places I felt very uncomfortable going as an actor. Things that he was given to do.
You mean like biting off a guard's face?
Just how completely Machiavellian he had become. How how completely overwhelmed his own humanity became by these events that he created for himself.
So your final scene, you're basically executed by Gemma's son, by your wife's son. And, you know, other people, including your wife, are just like standing there either in the room or just outside the room, watching, you know, watching from in the room or watching through the window from just outside. So, and you're shot in the neck and then shot several times in the chest. Can you just talk about what went through your mind when you knew this was your last scene and you're getting killed in an especially, you know, brutal way? It's an execution. So you're probably experiencing like the real pain of knowing this is the end for you as an actor, and then you're experiencing your character's pain as he's getting executed.
Well, by the time we reached that penultimate moment, I had already made my peace with everything, you know, and did all my adjusting to the various things that happened that were kind of out of left field for me. Now, if you know, it depends on who you talk to about this. I mean, you know, if you talk to the creator of the show, he's gonna give you a whole list of reasons why this was essential and inevitable and all that stuff. As these things were imparted to me, I had to evolve to a place where not only could I execute them in a way that was commensurate with how I wanted to play the character, or, you know, the same professionalism that I bring to bear in anything that I do, whether I love it or not, and the fact that, you know, this was a great run. This was a six-year triumphant run, the longest I've ever participated in any avenue of show business. 6 years, you don't get a chance to do that very often. It would have been nice if it was seven, but it was six. And you can't take that away. And I made some great friends, and the world still is kind of rocked by this phenomenon that was and is Sons of Anarchy. Everywhere I go, people just want to stop and talk to me about it. So I'm not going to let anything overwhelm how beautiful and how blessed an opportunity this was in the big scheme of things.
Can you describe what it's like to experience the death of a character you've inhabited for 6 years, where, you know, like the character shot in the neck, you have to give as realistic a performance as you can, not having experienced anything like that, obviously. So what are you thinking in that moment where you're shot?
Well, what you're thinking is, let me get this moment right, you know. Did I like the fact that I was shot in the jugular, that Jax, you know, readjusts his aim to make it even uglier than it needed to be? No, I mean, you know, Ron and Clay are two separate entities, but Ron is hired to play Clay. And so Ron doesn't exist in that moment. All that exists is getting it to the point where everyone who's playing that scene is on the same page and you make it look as realistic as possible. It's a brutal moment. It represented something none of us wanted to see, which is us no longer contributing to this thing that we had all been a part of building. These guys are going to see it. They're about a month away from ending the shooting of season 7, which is the final season. And they're all going to understand what it's like to say goodbye to a character they've been playing for that long a time. And it just happens. Is it fun? No. But is it inevitable? I mean, the minute you start something, it's going to end. And if you get a chance to go as long and as make as much noise as we did, then, you know, there's the good far outweighs the parts of it that you're probably hearing in my voice right now, which is that it's difficult.
I want to ask you about Hellboy. You have such a following for those two movies. And this is a couple of films directed by Guillermo del Toro, who also did Pan's Labyrinth. And it's based on comic books. Do you want to describe the Hellboy character for listeners who aren't familiar with it?
Well, Hellboy is summoned to Earth in a ritualistic kind of ceremony in the dark of night in the middle of World War II by the Third Reich. He's summoned when Hitler realizes the tide is turning and his momentum is starting to change, and he's starting to be the hunted rather than the hunter. And so he calls upon this fantasy character, Rasputin, to perform the ceremony that summons Hellboy. And Hellboy is the seed of destruction. Hellboy is there to be the ultimate tool of the Third Reich to finally finish what they set out to do, which is to destroy humanity and build a new world order. So that's who Hellboy is and is intended to be. But he's raised by this Western scientist named Professor Broom, as played by John Hurt in the films. And he's taught to use all of his powers for good rather than for evil. So Hellboy is the quintessential discussion of nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm. And in the role, you have horns, kind of like devil horns, that you've filed off. So you just see the stumps. You have a tail. You not only have a lot of prosthetic makeup on your face, you kind of have a prosthetic body, like prosthetic muscles, a prosthetic chest.
Yeah, I don't think people really... I think they think those are my muscles. I'd really rather keep it at that, if it's okay with you, Tara.
Sorry about that. is it hard to act with all of that on?
Everybody thinks it's burdensome to sit in a makeup chair for as long as it takes to transform and to have to maneuver your way through that stuff all through the day. But for crying out loud, I'm Hellboy at the end of it all. I mean, I never stop thinking about how many guys wish they were me, wish they had a chance to walk in his shoes and have that swagger and play that guy. And so whatever you have to go through to get to the point where you become Hellboy, it's worth it.
Did you know and love the comics before you got the role?
I deliberately refused to immerse myself in the world of the comics because I never thought Guillermo, who I was always his first choice to play the character, but it took him 7 years to convince the guys who write the big checks to actually write one with Ron Perlman as the title character, because let's face it, you know, it's a business. And I was never a household name, and I never expected that Guillermo would pull it off. So I didn't want to fall in love with a character and a world that I knew I would never be able to participate in, because that just would have been more heartbreaking than the reality of it. When he finally pulled it off and got greenlit by Sony for the first film, then I took out all the comic books that he bought me over the years and finally read them and fell in love face-to-face with the character.
Let's talk about your early years. Your father was a musician. He was a drummer. And before the children were born, he played in swing bands. You say he played with Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, and others. Was he a regular member of the bands, or did he sit in with them on tour?
He never rose to that level. He never played with those guys. I think what I was trying to infer is that he played in the time of those guys.
Oh, I see.
He was always kind of a, you know, low-level kind of a guy. Mm-hmm. Devoted to those artists, by the way. You know, those were his heroes. But he never played with those guys. He was just kind of a blue-collar guy who, you know, gigged from here and there and scratched out a few bucks, but never enough when it came time to raise a family to really feel like he could stick with this as his bread and butter.
So what did he do professionally?
So then he went to technical school and learned television and radio. TV was kind of just in its infancy at that point, so I guess that seemed like a rather good idea at the time. Television and radio repair, so that he would go to people's homes whose TV didn't work and fix them. And he became known as Honest Bert Perlman because he charged $3 for a house call.
Gosh.
And never raised his prices. That's probably why he was such a lousy TV repairman, is because he didn't change with the times.
And then he became a teacher?
And then, yeah, in his mid-40s, he started realizing that kneeling down behind TVs and pulling out picture tubes was probably losing its charm. So he found out that if he could use his practical time that he spent in the business and apply them to educational credits. And he started teaching in a vocational high school in New York, TV and radio technology. And that's when he found out what he was really born to do. He was really born to be a teacher. He only got a chance to do it for about 3 or 4 years before he was felled by this massive heart attack that actually took his life at the age of 49. But he found out what he was supposed to do before it was too late. So for that, I am eternally grateful.
Since he had initially wanted to be a professional musician, did he support you in your teenage years, or do you think he would have supported you later on in your ambition to become a professional actor, to have a life in the arts?
Well, he was wary of any noise that either of his sons made to sort of pursue a life in the arts, because he knew how precarious it was, and he knew what the odds were of success or of just even scratching out enough of a living to, you know, be able to use the word security. And, you know, him having grown up as a Depression baby, security was really paramount to that generation of parents. And then this thing happened where he saw me in a play in college, and he came the first night with my mom and, you know, the whole rest of the family, and then he came back the second night by himself. And then the following day in the car, he pulls over as he's driving me someplace, and he goes, you know, I just came back last night to see if what I saw the night before was an illusion or whether it was reality. I said, what are you talking about, Pop? He said, I think you got to do this. And I said, do what? He goes, I think you got to be an actor. I think that's what you got to do. And I came back a second time to have another look at it, because it's a very hard thing for me to say, because I'm maybe asking you to... you know, inviting you into a life of abject terror and horror, you know, because I know how hard it is to make a living, but I think this is what you have to do. And a year later, he was gone. So this was the ultimate, like, almost like a deathbed wish, where he gave me permission, not only gave me permission, but gave me a certain resolve that only a father can give to a son. And it was beautiful. And it's taken me to where I am, you know, to this day.
So I want to thank you very much for talking with us, for sharing
My
some
pleasure.
Of your life with us. It's been a pleasure. And good luck with
it. Turns out I really like talking about me. So it's been really a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. And thank you.
Ron Perlman's new memoir is called Easy Street, The Hard Way. Coming up, as the fall TV season begins, our TV critic, David Bianculli, suggests some new shows worth watching. This is Fresh Air.